for a new, Bob is one of the seminal workers and thinkers in general relativity and in the issue of quantum field theory in curved space-time. It's an honor to have him here and to introduce him. I won't take very long, as he can get settled there. Bob has been at the University of Chicago for most of his career. He is now chair in the physics department. He got his PhD in Princeton in 1972, and immediately began contributing important works that my generation we studied very, very closely in quantum field theory and curved space-time and general relativity and related topics. There's a long, long list of things that Bob has done and contributed to, so I'll skip those. Many of them will come in the talk, which is on quantum field theory and curved space-time. Bob is the author of three books, one of them on the subject, and one of them is the canonical textbook in general relativity, so I imagine that most of you know him through that book. And he is here the rest of today and this evening, and there's lots of time to discuss in the afternoon and people would like to discuss with him, and I won't waste any of your time more.
Thank you very much. So, I want to tell you today about quantum field theory and curved space-time. Before I tell you what it is or what I'm going to do in the talk, let me first give you a couple of references, since I'm obviously not going to go into great technical detail on a lot of subjects. I will be saying a fair amount about free fields. This is all work that was well established more than a decade ago, and that you can find most of the details I've summarized in my lecture notebook, so I'll put in a plug for that. The work, though, on interacting quantum fields, perturbative interacting quantum fields, and all the normalization issues, though, is really of the last 10 or so years, and the details of what I'll be talking about appear in a series of papers by Brunetti and Freidenhagen and co-workers, and a series of papers by Stefan Hollands and me. So if you want to see more of the technical details, you can consult these references. Okay, so what is quantum field theory in curved space-time? Well, it's simply a theory where you treat all the fields except the space-time metric itself, so all of the matter fields, fully in accord with the principles of quantum field theory, but you treat gravity by a space-time metric, but you treat it classically in the framework of general relativity. Now, this is not, of course, expected to be an exact theory of nature. It's not really consistent to have part of your theory classical and part of it quantum. But I think it's reasonable to expect that it should be a good approximate description of nature in circumstances where the quantum effects of gravity itself don't dominate the situation. And I think it's very fair to say that although gravity has been treated classically in this theory, in this framework, nevertheless, quantum field theory and curved space-time has probably provided some of the deepest insights we have at the present time into the nature of quantum gravity. Now, what I want to do in this talk is, well, describe some of the key developments in the theory, many of which go back 30 years, or some of which go back 30 years or so, and then try to describe to you some aspects of the key aspects of the present status of the theory, where things stand, and things stand in an extremely satisfactory state, I should say. That'll be a main point of the talk. I should mention that I'm not going to discuss in this talk issues of back reaction. One could ask what effects the quantum fields have on the space-time geometry. That presumably would be described by the semi-classical Einstein equation, where you'd set the classical Einstein tensor equal to the expectation value of the stress-energy tensor. I'm not going to discuss that in this talk. I'm just going to be concerned with
the effects of the space-time, of curved space-time geometry on the quantum field. So I will be considering, in other words, quantum fields propagating in a fixed classical space-time background. Okay, well, a key aspect of the nature of quantum fields can be seen from the standard analysis of a free, I will be focusing in this talk on a scalar field in curved space-time, but if we look at a Klein-Gordon scalar field in flat space-time, I just want to quickly remind you of some key aspects of that and emphasize a particular aspect that often is not emphasized too greatly. So as you're all undoubtedly familiar and is done in the first chapter of essentially every quantum field theory book, if you take your field classically, decompose it into Fourier modes, you see that each Fourier mode has a harmonic oscillator type Hamiltonian, so that in fact a Klein-Gordon field is really nothing more than an infinite collection of decoupled harmonic oscillators. We know how to write down the quantum theory of a harmonic oscillator. So we just write down the quantum theory of an infinite number of them, and then sum them back up to get a formula for the quantum field operator at time t and point x. The point I wanted to emphasize, though, is that this sum doesn't converge. If you can't make sense of it as a formula holding at a given t and a given x. What does work, and therefore you can't define quantum fields at sharp space-time points, what does work is if you average the field, if you formally integrate this with some test function, and then look at the right side where you pass, interchange the summation and integration, that formula does make sense, does converge, and you can define quantum fields as operators smeared over space-time points, even though you can't define them at sharp points. Now, there's a remarkable interpretation that is given to the states of the quantum field, which as I, every time I think back in it, I find it sort of more remarkable that it really works and does a lot of things that one wants. You have a state for this infinite collection of harmonic oscillators that's the ground state of each oscillator. That's interpreted in quantum field theory as representing the vacuum. Nothing is there, I mean, which is ridiculous because the quantum field is always there. There's not any nothing to not be there, but it's a particular state of the quantum field. But anyway, that's kind of thought of as a state of emptiness or something and called the vacuum state. And then you similarly interpret the states that you would make by applying these creation operators or raising operators to the vacuum as a state which has n particles present. Now, this is all for a free theory. On the other hand, for an interacting field, the state of the field may look like a free field, or the field for appropriate states may behave like a free field at early and late times, in which case you get particle interpretations this way at early and late times. A thing that one pays a lot of attention to in quantum field theory is the relation between these early and late time particle descriptions given by the S matrix. That certainly contains a great deal of the dynamical information of the interacting theory. What I want to emphasize is that that's just really an auxiliary thing, what I'll be emphasizing in the talk, but really the theory should be about the local quantum fields themselves. The particle interpretation, though, is remarkably successful, and the way people talk about quantum field theory, one might think that it's really at a fundamental level being talked about as a theory of particles. One of the other things I wanted to emphasize with this quick review is that the definition of particles heavily relies on the presence of a time translation symmetry. I mean, the whole notion of the ground state of these oscillators depends on a time translation symmetry, and you can see the positive and negative frequency parts of the field are basically defining the annihilation and creation operators. If one didn't have a time translation symmetry, one wouldn't know what t was or which t to choose, and one wouldn't be able to uniquely at least make a decomposition of this sort. Well, no problem making decompositions of that sort. They're just highly non-unique in a space-time that doesn't have time translation symmetry. Now, one of the earliest modern type applications of quantum field theory in curved space-time took place in the mid-60s when Leonard Parker investigated the issue of particle creation in an expanding universe. And, well, he did much more than what I'm describing, but an interesting idealized special case to consider of the kind of thing he analyzed would be a situation where you start with a static universe, you let it expand and let it become static again. Because of the time translation symmetries here and here, you'd have notions of particles that are well defined, but one can then calculate the out annihilation and creation operators in terms of the in annihilation and creation operators, discover that they are different. The out annihilation operator is a linear combination of the in annihilation and creation operators. The out vacua and the in vacua therefore differ, which means you've got, in other words, spontaneous particle creation from the vacuum. And even in Parker's work, there are obvious questions that arise. If you considered a more realistic universe that didn't have an initial static state but started from a Big Bang singularity, how would you define particles there? Right. Similarly, how might you define particles at late times if the universe recollapses? Those questions are certainly not ones that have obvious answers. Well, what really gave historically an enormous impetus to the study of quantum field theory in curved space-time was, in fact, the study of particle creation by black holes. Now, a priori, one might have thought, and probably most people who thought about it did think, that a black hole would be one of the last places you might get some observably interesting particle creation effects. I mean, sure, particle creation maybe would occur near the singularity of a black hole, but that's deep inside the black hole. But the reason people looked at particle creation by black holes was because of the initial reason was because of a phenomena in classical general relativity that was noticed in the early 1970s known as super radiant scattering. If you send a wave in of the appropriate frequency and angular dependence, a classical wave now of a classical field, to a rotating black hole, and it's essential the black hole be rotating, then you can do that in a way that the there's a wave going on a black hole. The part of the wave that gets absorbed by the black hole carries negative energy as measured at infinity, and the part of the wave that comes back, that is scattered back out to infinity, then has more energy and amplitude than the initial wave. Well, physically, this phenomenon of super radiant scattering is very analogous to stimulated emission. Send in a wave through some set of excited atoms and it comes out with greater energy and amplitude than when you sent it in. But in situations like excited atoms and so on, it has been well understood that anytime you have stimulated emission, you must have spontaneous emission. So that strongly suggested that for a rotating black hole, you ought to have spontaneous particle creation occurring outside the black hole. And early on, when the phenomena of superradiance was discovered, Starobinsky pointed this out, and much more detailed calculations by Unruh shortly thereafter confirmed that. But what really, that didn't come as any great surprise and didn't cause any great stir in the relativity or other communities. But what did, of course, as everyone in this audience is undoubtedly very familiar, is the step that happened next. Because the calculations that in particular Unruh did for particle creation by a rotating black hole, considered a sort of idealized eternal black hole, not one that was created by gravitational collapse, but the mathematically idealized analytic continuation of such a space-time. That space-time contains, in addition to a black hole, a white hole. It has a past event horizon as well as a future event horizon. To do the calculation in this space-time, you need to put some boundary conditions on the white hole that say that no particles are emerging from the white hole. This notion of particles, again, comes into play. You don't want to spoil your results by having particles shooting out of the white hole, after all, so you have to put in some appropriate boundary conditions. Well, Unruh chose what seemed to be a very natural-looking condition, but it wasn't clear that that was really the physically correct condition. Hawking realized that you could evade that ambiguity by not considering this eternal black hole and going back to the physically more realistic case of a space-time describing gravitational collapse to a black hole. And as surely everyone in this audience is familiar, what he discovered, well, really did cause shockwaves and revolutions, because what he found was that you got a result that was different, significantly different from the result you would get by imposing this seemingly natural condition of no particles. And when you did carried through the calculation as Hawking did, you found that you got particle creation occurring at late times after the collapse, even in the case of a non-rotating black hole where classically there was no effect. And furthermore, that the flux of particles you got at late times was of a very familiar form. It was exactly thermal at a temperature given by the famous formula that I've written down here. Well, this result has had an enormous number of implications, which I'm just mentioning two of the most key ones here, because I want to spend the rest of the talk on some of the implications for quantum field theory, as opposed to the implications for, you know, the physical and thermodynamic implications of this result. But one of the main things that the Hawking calculation did was tie up in a beautiful way the connection that had already been discovered by completely different arguments of a purely classical nature between laws of black hole physics and ordinary laws of thermodynamics. It showed that a black hole is a perfect black body. That's what everybody had expected, but everybody had expected that it was a perfect black body at zero temperature. What Hawking found is that it's a perfect black body at non-zero temperature, and that was exactly what was needed to make consistent a true thermodynamic interpretation of first law of black hole mechanics and the area theorem as representing thermodynamic laws for black holes. That the identification of the first law of black hole mechanics with the first law of thermodynamics then also gave rise to this famous Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of a black hole, and ramifications of that are still being very actively pursued more than 30 years after this formula was written down. Another extremely interesting ramification of the Hawking effect was, as was noted not long after the discovery, the particle creation, of course, will cause an energy flux to infinity. That will cause the black hole to lose mass. It'll lose mass at an ever-increasing rate, so the back of the envelope calculation suggests then that a black hole should evaporate within a finite time. In the semi-classical analysis of this process, an initial pure state then evolves to a final mixed state. One has so-called information loss, and an issue that has been debated for more than the 30 years since this was noted is whether that happens in the full quantum theory as well. So I think it's fair to say that these and other, some other ramifications of Hawking's results have provided us with some of the deepest insights we have into the nature of quantum gravity. But what I want to focus more on now is some of the insights into the nature of quantum field theory. I had already mentioned the in the Unruh calculation, there was sort of a natural notion of particles, and one put on a condition at the white hole horizon that no particles were emerging from the white hole. Well, if you made that same kind of definition near the black hole in the Hawking calculation, what you find is a divergent density of these ultra-high frequency particles near the event horizon of the black hole. And a question that was debated hotly at the time and seems to reemerge every now and then in the literature in various other forms concerns what do these particles mean, and you know, is there some danger that their presence is in some sense destroying the black hole? Well, that's where shortly after these issues were raised, Unruh stepped in and took a major, well, I think cleared up what is going on in this situation. So he took an operational kind of view of a particle, made a model of a particle detector, and said a particle is just a state of the field that makes a particle detector register, rather than being some a priori mathematical definition in terms of the fields and time translations. And what he found was that in Minkowski space-time, when the field is in its ordinary vacuum state, if you have a uniformly accelerating observer, it will see an exactly thermal spectrum of particles in this sense at a temperature given by a formula that is very, well, that's the exact analog of the Hawking formula if you extrapolate the Hawking formula to near the event horizon for stationary observers. It coincides then exactly with the Hawking formula, temperature being acceleration over 2 pi. Well, that explained what was going on in this Hawking calculation with, or in terms of what does this divergent density of particles mean. In fact, if you have a stationary observer just outside the black hole, such an observer will see this divergent density of particles near the horizon. But that observer is accelerating more as you bring that observer closer to the horizon to observe this diverging density. That observer is accelerating more and more, and an accelerated observer with that acceleration in flat space-time would also see a diverging density of particles. So it's an effect of the acceleration, really, not in some physical effect. In fact, a freely falling observer would not see any particularly strong effects as that observer gets near the event horizon or crosses the event horizon of the black hole. And the stress energy of the quantum field does not become large near the black hole. It's a very tiny effect if we have a large black hole. Okay, so what lessons then can one pull out of this work? Well, as I should be clear already from the tone I'm taking in this talk, the notion of particles is not fundamental in quantum field theory. To understand these phenomena like particle creation by black holes, the Unruh effect, and what various observers near the black hole, freely falling or stationary, will see, you really have to think of quantum field theory as the theory of fields, not particles. Furthermore, with the exception of space-times with a time translation symmetry and maybe some other space-times with some very special properties like conformally flat space-times if you're considering conformally invariant fields, there's no natural or preferred notion of a vacuum state and correspondingly no natural or preferred notion of particles. I mean, obviously, if we have an approximate time translation symmetry, we'll have an approximate notion of particles, but at a fundamental level, we don't have such a notion. But that poses some serious challenges to formulating quantum field theory in a general curved space-time. Because if we try to do it in the usual way of constructing a Hilbert space and constructing the field as an operator, and we construct this Hilbert space as a Fock space based on some vacuum state, different choices of vacuum state can lead to inequivalent Hilbert space constructions of the theory, unitarily inequivalent ones. Which one do we use? What's the criteria for that? Well, it turns out there's a very simple and elegant answer to this question that very nicely takes care of all the issues, which is to formulate the theory in the algebraic approach and formulate the predictions of the theory not in terms of particles, but in terms of the probabilities for the local field observables. Now, when I say algebraic approach, one usually thinks of these thick books with a lot of heavy mathematical theorems in them. But in fact, what I have in mind here is something that is so trivial that, in fact, I'm going to spend a view graph on this of how to construct the field algebra just for the entire purpose of trying to show you that it's completely trivial and that there's really nothing much involved. Then I'll describe how you talk about states within this approach. But I will, except for proving existence of states, which would take a bit of work, I will, in the next couple of view graphs, completely construct quantum field theory in curved space-time as far as this limited set of observables is concerned, and the rest of the talk will be discussing a much richer set of observables, and which will provide enough also then to do perturbative interacting quantum field theory in curved space-time. So to define an algebra of observables adequate for defining free quantum field theory, at least with respect to the linear field itself and its correlation functions, to construct this algebra, all you do is write down the free algebra, namely, write down all formal sums of finite sums of products of fields and their stars. I'm taking into account that the fields have to be thought of as distributions, so instead of evaluating them at a point x, I'm smearing them in with various test functions. So write down all expressions of this sort, and then say two expressions are equivalent if they can be manipulated into each other using linearity of the field in the test function, using this reality condition on the field, using the fact that the field satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation, and finally using the canonical commutation relations, which I've written here in space-time smeared form, where this delta denotes the advanced minus retarded classical Green's function, and the space-time has been assumed to be globally hyperbolic in order that we have uniquely defined advanced and retarded Green's functions. So the algebra that defines the quantum field theory is simply this free algebra factored by these relations. So those relations have just been imposed by hand, and there's nothing more to the algebra. But you should note that the observables in the algebra, the elements of this thing, are just essentially the correlation functions of the field itself. I don't have any stress energy tensors or phi squareds or things of that sort in the algebra, but we'll get to that later. So having defined the algebra, yeah.
Define the delta. The delta here is the advanced minus retarded Green's function, which would normally be written as a function of x and x prime, but I've smeared in with test functions to make it all totally 100% mathematically.
I is because there should be indexes on the field.
No, this is just the identity operator in the algebra. Yeah, that's not an index. That's the identity element. So in I suppose I should have said here in the free algebra, you take these things plus the identity element. Is thrown into the algebra. Okay, that's the entire story of the construction of the algebra of observables for the free field. At least, well, we're going to go beyond this shortly. Okay, then what are
states? Well, what I'm saying here is stuff that's been well known for 40 or 50 years, but not well known among most physicists, and I think this is worth knowing. So in the algebraic viewpoint, a state is just a linear map from the algebra of observables into the complex numbers that satisfies this positivity condition, where this star is the star that appeared in the algebra. And A is some arbitrary element, so it's some finite sum of finite products of the field correlation, of products of the field. So what does this have to do with the notion of states as vectors in a Hilbert space? Well, if you happen to have a Hilbert space where the fields, the observables of the theory are represented as operators by some, so pi of A is some operator corresponding to the algebra element A, then if you define omega of A by take the expectation value of this pi of A, that will define a state in this sense because it will be linear and it will also satisfy this positivity condition. The less trivial half of that of this correspondence is that if you are given a state on the algebra, then this positivity condition is exactly what you'd need to make this algebra into an inner product space. Well, not quite, because you might have zero norm things, but you can then factor it out by the zero norm vectors. You can then complete what you have left to get a Hilbert space. And this Hilbert space will naturally carry a representation of A, because you know how to multiply vectors in your space or how to act on them by elements of A, namely by algebra multiplication. Finally, you can notice that the identity element in this Hilbert space, A has been made into a Hilbert space, if you call that psi, will satisfy the property that the original algebraic state you were given is the operation of take the expectation value in the state psi. So in other words, every state in the algebraic sense corresponds to a state in the usual Hilbert space sense. So the algebraic states aren't really different, but what is particularly nice in this algebraic way is you get all states, you can simultaneously consider all states arising in all different in equivalent Hilbert space constructions of the theory. You don't have to make some choice of representation at the outset. You're perfectly free to consider all of them at once. Well, that is the full construction of free quantum field theory in curved space-time, except for the demonstration that there exists some states where you'd have to do a little bit of work. But that's not, that's not where one wants to end up. One wants to go quite a bit beyond that, really for two independent, well, slightly related, but independent reasons. Even if we were thought that the theory of a free field was the whole story of nature and we didn't feel we needed to go any further, this A is that I've defined, this algebra of observables, is inadequate because there are a lot of observables of interest, perhaps most important one being the stress energy tensor of phi, that's not represented in this algebra. If we don't believe, and I don't think anybody in this room believes, that free field theory is the entire story in physics, we'd want to construct interacting fields. Even in flat space time, we only know how to do that perturbatively. But the perturbative rules for constructing them require that you be able to define these nonlinear observables, first of all, though those will appear in your interaction Lagrangian in particular. But then in the perturbative formulas, you have to define time-ordered products of these polynomial expressions. So if we want to define this, we need some enlarged algebra of observables that defines them. But there are some obvious difficulties. If we try to define phi squared by some limiting procedure, like what I've written down here, where you let f of n approach a delta function, well, you find that you just get nonsense. I mean, you get diverging results. So you need some sort of regularization to even define something as simple as phi squared or stress energy tensor. If you then, having, say, solved this problem, try to define time-ordered products, well, it's straightforward to define time-ordered products by time ordering when the supports of the test functions can be assigned a definite time ordering, or when they, more generally, when they have suitable causal properties. But the problem is it's far from obvious how to extend this distribution to the total diagonal when all of the test functions overlap, or basically when all of the points appearing in this time-ordered product coincide. Okay, so of course these problems are solved in Minkowski space-time, so what are the challenges to going beyond the linear theory, to doing this extension that I just described in curved space-time, since people know how to do things in flat space-time? Well, the way I presented things, it might look like the hard problem is being able to define things like phi squared, where you get divergent results, rather than the more subtle divergences that occur when you try to define time-ordered products. In fact, though, this problem is solved in, again, the first chapter of most quantum field theory books by a normal ordering prescription, which is usually interpreted as subtracting off the vacuum expectation values of the field. So, you get infinite stress energy tensor due to the infinite zero point energies of all the modes, but you subtract off the contributions of the zero point stress energy to the stress energy tensor, and you end up with a finite result, which is the normal ordering. However, as I've emphasized, in curved space-time, there's no preferred vacuum state. So what do you normal order with respect to? Or if you don't normal order, what do you do? It's not obvious. If you look at the renormalization prescriptions that you use to define time-ordered products in Minkowski space-time, I claim that all of them use in one or more of the following. They use momentum space methods, that is, they take global Fourier transforms, or they use Euclidean methods, which involve doing an analytic continuation to Euclidean space by sending T to IT, doing some regularization or doing the calculations there, and then analytically continuing back to Minkowski space-time. Well, if you ask what do you need to do things like this, you need, well, translational or more generally Poincaré symmetry. Well, for the normal ordering, as I've already said, you very much need a Poincaré invariant vacuum state, and/or you need the ability to do some operation like sending T to IT, giving you a Riemannian metric rather than a Euclidean metric. Well, again, you don't have any symmetries generically in a curved space-time. You don't have any preferred vacuum state, and obviously if you don't have Poincaré symmetry, you don't have Poincaré invariance. And if you consider a non-static metric, sending some T coordinate to IT is just going to give you a complex metric and make your life worse rather than giving you a nice Riemannian metric. So all of these features are absent in a general curved space-time, which raises a question of what do you do and how do you define the renormalization? Well, a main point that I want to be conveying to you, even though I'm not going to be providing a lot of the details, is that problem has been solved in the last 10 years. There is a completely well-defined prescription for defining nonlinear functions of a free field and time-ordered products of these nonlinear polynomial functions that then is adequate to being able to define the perturbation theory. Rather than giving you, though, the details, which I certainly don't have time to do, let me, I will state what the results are, certainly by the end of the talk, but I just wanted to mention and describe a couple of key ingredients that have gone into making a lot of the progress, just so you have a little bit of a flavor of what's been involved. So one of the things that has been realized in the last decade is that a mathematical tool that was developed in the really in the late 60s and early 70s primarily has been extremely useful, has really been just the right tool needed for analyzing divergences of quantities in quantum field theory. So the tool that I'm talking about is known as microlocal analysis, and the basic idea of microlocal analysis is to provide a refined characterization of the singularities of a distribution. If you have a distribution, well, you want to know what it's doing near point X, so you really have to multiply it by some smooth function of compact support near X, and the statements that are true for all such localized distributions then are the ones that you're interested in. After you've localized this distribution near point X, you can take its Fourier transform. And the point is that the decay properties of the Fourier transform in K space, really the cotangent bundle, the cotangent space at X is really what you're effectively looking at. The decay properties characterize the singularities of, in a much more refined way, the singularities of the distribution. Basically, if there were no singularities of the distribution at X, then the Fourier transform would decay more rapidly than any inverse polynomial in K. If in some direction it fails to decay that rapidly, you call that direction singular, and you thereby get a characterization of the singularities of a distribution not just in configuration space, but actually in phase space, the phase space of the manifold or the cotangent bundle of the manifold. So the wavefront set, which is defined as the singular points and directions of a distribution, has proven to be a very useful tool because by looking at the wavefront set, you can, in many cases, define operations that normally would be ill-defined for distributions. I mean, for example, you can't normally take the product of distributions, but if two distributions have this wavefront set characteristic, then their product can be defined straightforwardly in terms of Fourier convolutions. So microlocal analysis has provided a very useful calculus for defining renormalization schemes and for showing that they are or are not, as the case may be, well defined. Another totally different key ingredient, I think, that's gone into some of the recent progress is formulation of the notion of a quantum field theory and quantum fields being locally and covariantly defined. This notion, to a large extent, replaces and has essentially the same power as notions of Poincaré invariance as applied in flat space time. In fact, I'll explain what I'm about to say would seem to have absolutely no relationship to Poincaré invariance, but I'll explain the relationship in just a moment. So if we're trying to define, extend the algebra and define field quantities like phi squared or time-ordered products of fields like what I've written down. What we want our definition to be, we would like our construction intuitively to satisfy the condition that you're not using anything to define phi squared near point X except the space-time geometry near X. That idea can be formalized as follows. If you happen to have a space-time, a region of a space-time MG that is isometrically embedded into a region O prime of some other space-time. So these two space-times may be very different, but one local region of one agrees with a local region of another. Then these embeddings will induce in a natural way an isomorphisms of the local field algebras of O and O prime. The demand that a field like phi squared is locally and covariantly constructed out of the space-time geometry is the demand that when you identify the field algebras of O and O prime, the quantity that you designated as capital phi, for example, phi squared in O, is taken under this isomorphism of the local algebras into the same quantity in O prime. In other words, you're not using any global properties of the space-time or any other extraneous information in defining phi squared. You're just using the local information about the space-time geometry. So what does this, I said this was playing a role analogous to the role of Poincaré invariance in flat space-time. What does that have to do with, what does one have to do with each other? With the other, well, you can isometrically embed all of Minkowski space-time into itself by a Poincaré transformation. If you take this local and covariance postulate, that implies that under the induced isomorphism of the field algebras induced by this Poincaré transformation, the field gets carried into itself. In other words, the field is Poincaré. The local and covariance condition, when applied to the case of Minkowski space-time, implies that the definition of a field like phi squared is done in a Poincaré covariant manner. But the point is, this local and covariance fields condition applies to any space-time with no assumption of symmetries of any kind, and it gives a very powerful restriction then on the definition of the quantum field quantities, right? So it carries much of the essential content of the conditions that Poincaré invariance is used for in Minkowski space-time quantum field theory, but now it's a condition that makes sense in arbitrary curved space-times. So how can one proceed to define quantities like phi to the n? There isn't any obvious mechanical prescription for defining it, but you can write down a list of properties that one would like phi n to satisfy. I just explained the condition that it be local and covariant. That's one of the key conditions. Another key condition is the commutation relation should be what the classical Poisson bracket would give you, which is what I've written here. It's a reality condition. If you have a regular state, you'd want the expectation value to be smooth. Then another condition is that if you vary the space-time metric smoothly or analytically, and or smoothly or analytically vary the coupling parameters, you want the definition of phi to the n to vary smoothly. That takes that's a non-trivial idea to formulate and in a precise mathematical way, so I won't attempt to do that here, but this is the idea of the condition. And then finally, you might demand that phi n have the same classical scaling, same scaling behavior as it has classically under a scaling of the space-time metric. That condition is impossible to impose. If you impose this, you could prove there is no quantum field theory. But if you relax that by allowing polynomial in log lambda deviations from scaling, then you can impose this. If you want to do time-ordered products, there's a similar set of axioms, but the smoothness condition is replaced by a much more complicated microlocal spectrum condition that basically says the singularities are of a positive frequency kind of type. And then there are some additional unitarity and causal factorization conditions that one would add in. The claim is that the properties written down for phi squared actually uniquely determine how phi squared is to be defined up to a well-defined, in this case, one parameter ambiguity. The commutation relation, let me just be brief about this so I don't run over. The commutation relation basically uniquely determines phi squared up to a multiple of the identity. The local and covariance condition together with the scaling condition force the multiple of the identity to be a constant multiple of the scalar curvature, and that's the uniqueness of phi. And inductively, one can see that as you go up to higher powers, you just introduce new non-uniqueness constants, but there's just a finite number of parameters at each, characterize the non-uniqueness of phi to the n. And a similar but much more complicated argument for time-ordered products also yields uniqueness up to some specified ambiguities, which if you look at what those ambiguities give rise to in an S matrix is very familiar in what one might expect. They correspond precisely to the ambiguities you would get by adding counterterms to the Lagrangian, which now, though, would include curvature couplings that have the appropriate dimension. That's uniqueness, but what about existence? Because it's not going to be much of an achievement if there is nothing that satisfies all this, even if it's unique or nearly unique. But in fact, it's not hard to show that one can construct this enlarged algebra of observables with the appropriate definition of phi squared and so on, or more generally any Wick powers. Let me just focus on phi squared. I mean, the same arguments apply to the stress energy tensor and, generalized versions apply to arbitrary polynomial observables in phi. Instead of doing normal ordering, which could be thought of as subtracting off from the product of the fields at different points the vacuum expectation value, the normal ordering prescription would be take this product, subtract, it would be equivalent to take this product, subtract off the vacuum expectation value of this, and then take the limit as x goes to x prime. Instead of doing that, there is no preferred vacuum state in a curved space-time, but one can subtract off some locally and covariantly constructed so-called Hadamard parametrics, and then prove that the resulting object has singularity structure that allows you to smear it in this manner, thereby providing one with a satisfactory definition of phi squared that satisfies the whole list of axioms. One thing I want to point out is that this h that you're subtracting off is not the expectation value of phi in any state, vacuum or otherwise. This is this definition of phi squared or the corresponding definition of stress energy tensor does not have any interpretation as subtracting off some zero-point energy or, associated with some vacuum state. But it's a completely well-defined prescription. Let's see. Yeah. So I. So there is a similar argument, but much more complicated again, that gives existence of prescriptions for time-ordered products that satisfy all of the conditions that I haven't written down here, but mentioned to you or indicated to you the nature of what they were. So let me summarize, since I'm near the end of my time in any case, what the key results of everything that I'm just describing, that I've been describing for the last hour, have been. So there exists a completely well-defined prescription for defining polynomial observables in a free field that satisfies this list of axioms, which include the fact that the field is local and covariant and a whole list of other reasonable properties. The prescription is unique up to certain specified ambiguities, as I indicated while I was considering, as I indicated, the ambiguity for phi squared in curved space-time is just a multiple of the scalar curvature. You could also have a multiple of the mass squared if you're considering a massive field. In the case of a massless field in Minkowski space-time, these ambiguities disappear, and the prescription can be seen to agree with normal ordering. But on a general curved space-time background, the prescription for defining phi squared has these ambiguities and does not agree with normal ordering with respect to any choice of vacuum state. Similarly, for time-ordered products, there exists a prescription that defines the time-ordered products in a local and covariant way and satisfies a list of additional reasonable properties. This prescription is unique up to the kind of renormalization ambiguities that one would have expected from everything that's known in Minkowski space-time. But of course, there are extra local curvature type ambiguities that come into the situation, come into the formulas in flat space-time. An important corollary of all this analysis, I mean, this gives the ingredients to do perturbative interacting quantum field theory in curved space-time. And one can then see that theories that are renormalizable in Minkowski space-time remain renormalizable in curved space-time. And renormalization group flow can be defined in a very natural manner in terms of the way the quantum field behaves under scaling of the space-time metric. I should emphasize that the quantum field theory is defined for all possible globally hyperbolic curved space-times. It's actually essential that we be defining the theory in all globally hyperbolic space-times if we were only trying to define it in some restricted set, the local and covariance condition would have much less power and we would have much weaker results on uniqueness. Finally, it's worth mentioning that one can impose additional renormalization conditions on the theory, on the definition of the time-ordered products and the Wick powers, so that in perturbation theory, order by order, the interacting quantum field will actually satisfy the interacting equation of motion. And most importantly, I think to have this theory have a chance of providing one with some consistent semi-classical description of gravity, the stress energy tensor in the interacting theory order by order can be assured to be conserved. That is, the conditions can be imposed that ensure that it's conserved. Again, everything that I've described has been obtained and shown without any appeal to a notion of vacuum state or particles or anything like that. So In fact, on that sort of theme that I indicated near the beginning of the talk and want to just return to now, I think it's fair to say that quantum field theory in curved space-time has provided us with quite a number of deep insights into the nature of quantum gravity and the nature of phenomena in strong gravitational fields, but also into the nature of quantum field theory itself. I feel very strongly that there's no question that the notion of particles should join notions like simultaneity, gravitational force, and things like that as being a notion that, of course, we find extremely useful in informal discussions. But at a fundamental level, there's no meaning to saying, you know, right now in the Andromeda galaxy, just at the same instant as I'm saying this, something is happening. I mean, that there's ambiguities in that. There's, in general relativity, in a general situation, absolutely no notion corresponding to gravitational force. But of course, in the situations that we're normally in our everyday lives, these are very good approximate notions, though at a fundamental level, they're ambiguous and meaningless. But the main point I want to emphasize is that despite the abandoning of the notion of particles in vacuum at a fundamental level, quantum field theory in curved space-time can be formulated in a completely mathematically and physically well-defined way and makes perfectly good sense as a theory, which really is what its name remarkably actually suggests, a theory of the locally observable quantum fields themselves. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Bob, for a beautiful talk. We have lots of time for discussions and questions. Jim was first.
Do ideas like asymptotic freedom or asymptotic safety, do you expect those to be modified for curved space-time? Or will we just be able to do those calculations in flat space-time and say, well, short distance will go automatically over?
Well, I wouldn't expect, you know, curved space-time to play any important role in something like asymptotic freedom, you know, which the short distance structure is becoming more and more Minkowskian.
Yeah,
you know, the renormalization group flow is all, you know, can be completely generalized to curved space-time in this framework, and I wouldn't expect curved space-time to play any important role in.
One more question.
Yeah.
Is the notion of a Schrodinger picture another thing which has to join the ranks of simultaneity, gravitational force, and particles? That is where you have, you know, states evolving through space-time, right?
Well, I mean, you can always make, you know,
is
at least if you're working in a fixed Hilbert space, you can always make the states evolve rather than the fields or something. It's a little funny and awkward because you really have to smear the fields in space-time to define your observables, but you know, you could then, well, it's a little strange, I suppose, if you don't have a time translation symmetry, it is a bit odd to kind of keep the observables fixed and make the states evolve,
but
I think you can do it.
You want to get rid of the notion of particle and vacuum as well to the same.
Well, I don't necessarily want to get rid of them.
Well, you think they are there, right? My question is, what about ground state? We're used to thinking of vacuum as the ground state.
Yeah.
But if ground state joins the ranks of simultaneity, how do we understand things like the stability of a theory? How could I say one theory is stable, has a stable ground state, relative to another theory that doesn't?
Well, I mean, again, if you have a time transit, so first of all, I'm only talking about, of course, quantum field theory, curved space-time, you know, classical background, et cetera, and so on. But anyway, if you have a time translation symmetry, then you can define a good notion of the ground state, and you can define a good notion of the mapping state. That is well defined. If you don't have time translation symmetry, then I'm not even sure in what sense you want to say that there is something that's stable. Like if you have an expanding universe, you'll have particle creation. I mean, what?
So the notion of stability is perhaps also in this category in some sense?
Yeah, or it's not. I mean, there's not an obvious notion of stability anymore. I mean, again, you know, you can surely define some physical criteria that would enable what, you know, that everyone would agree if it satisfies this physical criteria, it's stable. You know, there's not too much stuff going on. You know, and that you could presumably show in the appropriate cases, but there's no kind of mathematically obvious or natural notion of what you mean by stability when you don't have the time translation symmetry. In other words, when you have time translation symmetry, typically, you know, perturbations of the configuration you're considering will either oscillate or grow exponentially. But if you don't have a time translation symmetry, the perturbations will have a complicated time dependence that you know, can't be characterized in that kind of simple manner. And you know, before you could just say if you've got exponential growth, it's unstable. If it's all oscillatory, it's stable. But you know, off a dynamical background, if you have some, you know, growth that's not too fast, you might want to call it stable. I don't know.
You say you have an extension of, I mean, you have perturbation theory there. Does that mean that you have a Feynman propagator?
I'm sorry,
you say that you can do perturbation theory.
Yeah.
So what is the Feynman propagator you're using?
Not using the Feynman propagator.
So there's no notion of.
There is a time-ordered product of phi of x, phi of y that is defined, okay, but there's no vacuum to take that in to make it a, you know, there's no natural vacuum. I mean, of course, you could take its expectation value in whatever state you want, but there's no preferred notion of finding propagator. That would be equivalent to having a preferred notion of vacuum. But
So in
the algebra of observables, there is certainly this observable around, you know, that's well defined. The difficulty of defining a Feynman propagator, which I'm indicating in the dotted lines here, is putting in the vacuum. That's what is it around. So. But this is what you need to do the theory. You don't need that.
But to define, to define the directivity here, you need to renormalize. And this normalization depends on the, you know, property of your propagator on the vector state.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. When you do things. I mean, I haven't given you any of the details, but I mean, I'm glad you're asking that because that makes it look like what's been done is non-trivial, right? Totally avoiding ever mentioning any vacuum state and working with these objects, the claim is you can do all the renormalization theory. You could define to whatever order of perturbation theory you want to work what the interacting field algebra is, and you can, you know, in principle, answer very much in principle rather than in practice any question you want to ask about the, you know, observable local fields of the interacting theory to whatever, let's say, order of perturbation theory you want to act it. But you never, right, that's the whole point. You don't have this object, you can only work with this object.
But do you get a definite answer, or you get always an answer modulo these curvature of degrees?
Oh, well, in everything you get a definite answer modulo these finite number of parameters. I mean, I would say the same thing in flat space time. You get, you know, an answer modulo these parameters, which if they were normalizable theory, they were parameters you were already considering. And if you, you know, throw in the appropriate curvature couplings of the right dimension into your Lagrangian, then the ambiguous parameters with respect to calculating something like S matrix elements and so on, I mean, not necessarily with respect to calculating stress energy tensors or things like that, the ambiguities just correspond to the, if it's your normalizable theory, to the parameters in the Lagrangian. For, you know, stress energy tensor, you'll have extra quadratic and curvature ambiguities as well, and so on.
You said that the lesson of Unruh's argument was that one shouldn't think in terms of particles, just but instead should think in terms of But the way you describe it, it sounded like the lesson was that one should think operationally about physics. Does that mean the same thing in this case?
Firmly taking the view that at the fundamental level, what we really have are the fields, you know, plus devices coupled to fields, and so on. So, you know, if we're going to take an operational point of view, we have to really work with the fields. I mean, that's what's there. Maybe I'm not answering your question properly or not interpreting it correctly, but instead of trying to employ some higher level concepts like particles that don't, you know, whose definition doesn't really exist, or doesn't exist as a precise concept, you know, go back to the fundamentals of the theory, you know, say what you're doing in terms of the fundamentals of the theory, and calculate what you will see, you know, without using terms like particles or whatever to color the discussion. I mean, so you go back and you say, I have this two-level quantum mechanical system that's coupled in this way to the quantum field. The quantum field is in this state. The detector is in this motion. And I will see, you know, a transition from this level to that level with, you know, with this probability. I mean, that's what I would say is the operational point of view, whichever is taken, but it's also going back to describing, it essentially requires describing the, you know, the quantum fields as local fields, because that's what comes into the interaction with the apparatus.
Okay. So you subtracted out this H, which you called automatic parametrics.
Yeah.
You mentioned that it can't be interpreted as vacuum expectation value or any expectation value. Is there any, so to speak, physical interpretation of what it can be interpreted as?
No, I mean, not that I don't know how to think of it as, other than as part of the, you know, mathematical algorithm that is incorporated into quantum field theory for defining these things.
So it's motivated just as something that helps you to fulfill the axioms that you set up, or? I mean, how do we think of it? Do you think of it in terms of counter terms?
No, I don't think there's any counter term interpretation or anything like that.
How do you define page?
Oh, that's just, you know, there is an algorithm for constructing it. I mean, it's supposed to be a solution for the wave equation. And you know, demand that you're looking for a solution that's of the form of something over geodesic distance squared plus, in four dimensions, some term in log of sigma, and then you write out series-type expressions for these objects, and, you know, you can algorithmically calculate each term in the series for these objects by some, you know, prescription involving, I mean, these are, everything is a function of the two points x and x prime. This is squared geodesic distance between x and x prime. And, you know, there's a particular algorithm, well, for calculating this, that you don't need a series for this is just one term, and the series for this. If you look at the geodesic connecting x and x prime, you do some integral along the geodesic to define this. I mean, it's right. This was written down first by Adamard in the 1920s to, you know, use to explicitly locally construct a Breeds function. I mean, it's really in the elliptic case, but the, you know, the algorithm for doing this local construction can just be carried over.
Let me suggest that more technical discussion to be discussed with that after. Are there any there's a question right here?
Yep, I understand. So when you talk about the covariant calculation of the electrical tensor, so the reason that the game is that you want to keep some a semi-classical Einstein equation.
Yeah.
But there seems to be, in some sense, a more fundamental level reason that why one might want to keep it. For the reason that, say, if one tries to imagine a quantizing field theory in a curved background, one probably would like to make sure that one would like to have a quantization that is independent of the slicing that we want to choose. And that seems that seems to imply the fact that we would like to have a quantizing conserve for the field theory itself, rather than say we wanted to be consistent with Einstein equation. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I mean, so the reason I was giving just to, you know, is if we, you know, want to incorporate back reaction, which I, as I said, I did not talk about, but you know, want to impose an equation, you know, at the end of the day that says Einstein tensor is expected stress energy in whatever, you know, algebraic state we're considering. We're going to undoubtedly be in a lot of trouble unless the theory is made up so that in any space-time background this is conserved. Otherwise, this equation is almost sure to give mathematical inconsistencies with the Bianchi identity. So that was the reason I gave. Now, you seem to be suggesting that there's also, you know, conservation of energy type reasons. Well, I mean, in a curved space-time, this covariant conservation doesn't give rise to any global conservation laws, though, I mean, one could argue that, you know, this is what you need for a freely falling observer to locally see conservation of energy and momentum, and I would agree with that. That might be a condition one might want to impose, although I wouldn't necessarily say that you could. That would be a demand one would have to, you know, necessarily made.
I'm not sure that's exactly what I want. But that is what I want to say. So I think I'm trying to be very naive and just say I try to calculate some transition amplitude there, say, between the class integrals. Then there's a choice in terms of how I can choose the coordinates, right? I mean, just one would like the transition amplitude to be independent how one slice the space time between. Between an initial and final slice of that we want to consider. And And that condition itself seems to imply that
there's certainly a close relation between this and diffeomorphism covariance. And in fact, this requirement, coming out of perturbation theory actually does, maybe this carries a little too far afield, but the condition that ensures this in the interacting field theory is, or arises actually from a condition that demands that if you were to sort of calculate the curved space-time effects perturbatively off of some background, perturbatively in the metric now off of some background, you should get the same answers in the theory as if you did it directly in the metric for which you were doing the perturbation theory towards or something. So there's a condition of that sort which is closely related to the theory, the perturbative theory being diffeomorphism covariant, because the free theory in the background automatically is diffeomorphism covariant. So I haven't explained it, but anyway, there is a relationship easily seen classically, but also in the quantum field theory, between this condition holding and diffeomorphism covariance holding. And so there is a good reason, independent of the semi-classical Einstein equation. In fact, I think in agreement probably with what you're trying to say, is wanting to impose that condition.
And also, I don't quite see to what extent that is something that one wants to be at only at the perturbative level, say, rather than the whole number.
Oh, no, I would not like it at every level. I only know how to calculate it. I mean, for interactive fields, this is, we only know how to do the calculations. The perturbative level, but when we discover like it.
Let me just cut it here to suggest you have more discussion with Rob. There's one more quick question, Gabby, is quick and not technical.
So does it mean if you enlarge your eigenmap by including the pre-trivial discussion? So does it mean that every state just defined on the original eigenmap still exists as larger?
No, it definitely doesn't. The states get very restrictive. And the states get restricted to these Hadamard states. The enlargement of the algebra restricts the states to what used to be called Hadamard states on the original.
Our friends are running away. How do we thank Bob. In his office, if he's allowed to stay in his room and get that far.